We have a proverb where I'm from. I'm an Igbo man from Africa. I know I look Swedish, but don't worry, I'm from West Africa. We have a proverb. Ago anahe ebu nwata nne ya gara ahịa. Not a lot of good until I translate it. Literally, it says that hunger does not take the life of a child whose mother has gone to the market. Hunger never takes the life of a child whose mother has gone to the market. It's a proverb that, when used in the appropriate occasion, is supposed to ignite hope. It's simply saying that there is power in hope that's able to sustain people through difficult times. And so when you use that proverb in your interactions in my birthplace, you're trying to use it as an encouragement, as a reminder, through times of difficulty, that there is power in hope and expectation. Jay started a series, well, really shouldn't be a series, but Jay's sermon last Sunday began to remind us about the coming of Christ, but also about the promise of his second coming. And he made the point that, contrary to how his second coming has been talked about, often to cause fear, make people feel like, oh boy, that's when I'm going to be finally finished. He said it's actually meant to ignite hope. It's meant to be reassuring. It's meant to be, you know, there used to be a time in church history when the return of Christ was actually the selling point of the faith of Christians. It was the selling point in the first century, in the second century. The hope of Christ's return was the selling point of the Christian faith. But now it's become something, like Jay mentioned last week, that we're embarrassed to talk about. So today is a continuation of last week's sermon, but that hope, we're edging closer toward Advent. Advent is a time when liturgy allows us to again relieve the hope of the coming of Christ, of his being born, but also with sprinkles of his second coming. And today continues sort of that trajectory. And our parable, our gospel reading, is a parable today. The parable we often call the parable of the bags of gold or the parable of the talents, which, if you permit me, I'll just for this morning call the parable of the three apprentices. It's really about the apprentices. It's really about the servants more than it's about the bags of gold, but we'll get there. Before we get into the parable proper, let's back up a little bit to understand the conversation, because this was really within a wider conversation that's been going on. How did it start, and how did Christ get to that point so that we can locate ourselves in this parable? The disciples came to Christ with a question. He'd been talking about his second coming. So they came to him and asked him clearly the question that was probably in everybody's mind. Can you tell us when you will return and the signs that will let us know that you're about to return? Good question. And for full disclosure, I'm with them on that question. I wish I knew. It's that kind of question. I imagined myself in that midst. I would have had it in my mind. And I think I'd have asked it. Or if someone else beat me to it, I'll nod my head when they asked it. Because I'd like to know. At least if I knew, it will help me plan the most strategic time to retire. Probably help me know how many kids to have, depending on where the calendar was at. You know, it was a good question. Jesus answers that question not in the way in which they asked it. He began to give the answer, and he doesn't give them this scientific laboratory eyeball answer. No, or bull-eye answer. He rather paints a picture for them. And, you know, many times when we go back to that passage, we interpret it scientifically because we had wished he answered it scientifically. But he didn't. He pulls them on this trajectory and rather redirects them to what should occupy their minds about his coming. And he basically told them, it's not about the timing of my return. Rather, it's about being good disciples. And good disciples are not made by those who are able to decipher the timing of the return of their master. Good disciples are made by those who are occupied in those things that will make their master happy with them when he returns. That was basically the message. And that's why he tells them a few parables about, you know, the fig tree and about the man who owned the house and didn't know what time the thief was going to arrive. But then he drives them, that was Matthew 24, he brings them to verse 42 of Matthew 24. And I believe that it is verse 42 of Matthew 24 that Jesus gives what would be the driving admonition about how to be good disciples in his physical absence. He tells them, therefore, be watchful. Therefore, be watchful or be vigilant. That's going to be the driving admonition for what follows. And after he commands them to be watchful disciples, because you do not know the time or the hour. In fact, I'll read that. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you must also be ready always, because the Son of Man will come at an hour that you do not expect him. And it is from this driving admonition to keep watch that he offers them three parables. Our parable today, the parable of the three apprentices, is one of them, is the third one. The first parable is the parable of the wicked servant. Second is the parable of the 10 virgins or 10 bridesmaids. And finally, the parable of the talents. Excuse me. In the parable of the wicked servant, he tells them about a man who was going on a journey, and he hands over what he has to his manager, his chief servant, and tells them, hold down the fort, I'll be back. It's going to be a long journey. And the scriptures say he went on a long journey. That servant assumed that his master will be delayed, so he doesn't get to the master's task immediately. He begins by eating and drinking and beating up on other servants. The power got to his head, and he thought he had time to catch up. Well, the master returns after 4 days and finds him not doing what he asked him to do. That servant's mistake was with timing. He thought his master would be delayed, so he didn't get onto the job. He thought he had time to get to it. Then he tells them a second parable, the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. It's the flip side of the wicked servant's mistake. The wicked servant thought the master would be delayed, so he didn't get onto the job. The foolish bridesmaids thought the bridegroom will be early, so they didn't prepare for the long haul. It's the flip side. So there's the mistake about timing that thinks my master is going to be delayed, so I really don't have to get to it yet. And there's the mistake of thinking, well, this is all going to happen in 3 years and we'll be all done, so I'm not going to prepare for a faith that can weather the long haul. He said, when you read those parables together, he's saying, do not focus on the timing like it's going to be delayed. Do not focus on the timing like it's going to be soon. Rather, I'll tell you how best to watch. Focus on that which your master has handed over to you, not on the timing, so that you can keep it safe, preserve it, and advance it, so when he comes back, whenever he comes back, whether soon or late, when he comes back, he'll be happy with you. When you read those three parables in continuity, that's the central message. And from then on, he talks again about the last judgment and about his return and so on. So that's where we locate this parable. And I want to invite us again to look at this parable afresh from the eyes of the admonition that Christ is trying to give us, because there is something eventually that he handed to his disciples before he ascended again to heaven to come back a second time. And he's telling them through this that what makes a good disciple is not your ability to decipher times. What makes a good disciple is your dedication to that which will give your master joy when he returns. The parable. There was a wealthy man. He owned a big business. He started the business, he ran it, he was doing well. And as things happened, he was going to go on a journey, and he had servants. Some of them had been with him 15 years, some of them 20. So he picked on three of his major servants and said, "You're going to have to hold down the fort because I'm traveling to China to test out a new technology that I want to bring back. So you, why don't you handle the office in Chicago? That's the headquarters, a lot of money. Why don't you handle the one in Vernon Hills? Second one." And then he called the third one and said, "Yes, this new one we started 2 years ago. You know, I'm tempted to say Highwood, but let's make it Libertyville. We'll push the pressure to the people in Libertyville. We don't want pressure this morning." So he handed it to them and he caught his flight. He went off to China. He was delayed. There were defects in the whatever technology and stuff. He was delayed. But after a long time, he comes back. And the guy that was in the headquarters in Chicago was happy to see his master. And they went through it. The store was open. Everything was running fine. Didn't lose a single customer. Things were good. Same thing with Vernon Hills. And he drove up to Libertyville, and that office was closed down. And they started to talk about it. And, you know, when they talked about it, the master realized that it didn't really close down because there was a natural disaster in Libertyville. It didn't close down because something totally unexpected happened. It closed down because the servants made an executive decision to close it down in his absence. So he was curious. He said, "Okay, good, you made the decision. Why? Why did you do that?" And the servants, "You know what? I really don't like you. I never liked you. I don't agree with your ethos. I don't think this business is worth running. I don't agree with the principles of this business. I never had a good opportunity to do what I wanted to do. So when you were gone and you handed this to me, I thought I'd do what I always wanted to do." So the master is calculating in his head what loss that was. So he said, "Okay, you know, I'm going to take care of all that. In the meantime, I need to recover some of my loss and cut them. Maybe I'll get the insurance to cover some of the losses that I've incurred from this store getting closed down and things that have gone bad." And he calls the insurance company to see if he can recover part of the money at least. And they tell him, "Oh, no, you haven't been keeping up with your premium from that store. It's lost." And he says, "You wicked servant, you didn't even do the most basic thing that will at least allow me to recover some of the loss." He did not build that business with his master. In secondary school, high school, here, I had a friend named John. Very close friends. We went to the same high school. We called it secondary school. We went to the same church. We lived not so far away from each other. When we were coming real close to our graduation in high school, we were talking one evening, and we were talking about the future and all that. He told me that his father had told him to come join the business, and so he wasn't going to apply for entrance into a college. Around the same time that we were applying, he was going to join his father in his business. So we talked about it a little bit, and he was a little sad, a little happy, but he said, you know, my dad's been, this is what he does with all of us, he wants us to learn the business because he's worried that if he wasn't there, nobody else will really understand this thing, and this was going to die. His father dealt in textile, he was a textile businessman. So John and I talked a little bit about this. We remained friends, and eventually he went to serve his dad and to understand the business, and I went off to college, and on vacations, I'll come back. I'll actually go out to his store that he was managing, and I'll hang out with him a lot, go to lunch and all that. Sometimes I spent long hours there, and he paid me some money. You know, one day we were talking, and John told me something his dad told him. It stuck with me. In trying to bring him up to understand the business so he can carry it on, the dad had said to him, well, he said the dad says it all the time to other servants too. The textile business is like a piece of cloth. I'm translating it as best I can. Said it in Igbo. The textile business is like a piece of cloth. If you tailor it well, you will enjoy it and it will bring you happiness. If you sew it badly, it will bring you sadness and you will lose the value of it. It's like a piece of cloth. But that really goes for any other business. It's like a piece of cloth. It's like capital. It's like what you have in your hand to do eventually what you want, where you want it to get to. And in essence, he was inviting John to understudy him, to learn the skills of that trade, to learn the habits of that business, so that John will come to a position where he can take it over someday and run it and make something bigger out of it than his dad even did. That's what two servants did, and that's what one did not do for their master. It's a parable to tell us how to live while Jesus was gone to return. But how does this speak to us today? How could this parable speak to us today? You know, for many years that I've read this, and I've also heard it, I've been in group discussions where we discussed this parable, and I've also listened to sermons from this parable. And I feel like in trying to apply it, we tend to focus a lot on the bags of silver, on the bags of gold, and the numbers that he gave to one, 5 and 2 and 1. And that is valid. But I think that a lot, our eyes and our focus shifts to quantities and productivity and productivity levels, and what we can do, and what we've been given individually. And that, all that is valid. I see all that in the parable. But in thinking about us today and how to look at ourselves in this story, I want to invite us to just a slightly different perspective on how to read it. One question I really couldn't shake on my mind as I wrestled with this passage is, what exactly was it that Jesus handed us when he left? I couldn't shake that off. If I'm going to eventually try to grapple with this scripture, I have to ask that question. Beyond the parable, when you try to translate this to our lives today, what exactly, when he ascended, did he leave to us? There are many ways to see it. I'm only going to see it in one, at least talk about it in one way today. When Christ came, he proclaimed the kingdom of heaven. And he said, the kingdom of heaven is come upon you. That's when there was a birthing of the life of heaven on earth. And in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is presented as king from start to end. And he birthed the kingdom of heaven among humanity. In the wider context, he's promising that this kingdom that's been birthed in his coming, first coming, will be consummated in his second coming. It will grow to maturity, and we will enter into its fullness when he returns a second time. There's where you find the gap. What happens then between when this kingdom is birthed and when it grows to fullness, maturity? The master is going to be absent. And I think that what he handed to us to preserve and advance is that message of the kingdom, is that life of the kingdom. You see, and I went back and I read that parable again. What was it that the master left them? Really, we think about the gold and the five and the bags of silver. He left them his estate. He had an estate. A master had an estate. And he left them his estate, irrespective of how he divided the responsibilities. Irrespective of how he divided it up and said, you take care of that, you take care of that. But it was an estate that he was looking to preserve and possibly advance. There's a collective duty in our involvement in the kingdom work of Christ. There's a collectiveness to it. And we tend to read the individualized aspect of that parable, forgetting that the master left us an estate, and Christ left us at his ascension a certain responsibility, that something has been born. In his incarnation, he pushed back the works of darkness and brought light, as John declared in John's gospel, that light, he as light came into the world and the darkness could not overcome him. We were in a fallen state, and when he proclaimed the kingdom of heaven, he was breaking through with light in a world that had been laden with darkness. And when he leaves, he hands over this estate to his apostles, who in turn handed it over to the second generation, who in turn handed it over until it came down to us. And he is looking, what is he looking for? This estate, this message of the kingdom, this life of the kingdom, preserve it and advance it till I come back. Because when I come back, it will get to its total fulfillment. But I still, the problem is not all resolved, because if I leave it at he has handed us the kingdom, can I throw you under the bus, Tom? Tom and I meet, and Tom is always giving me a hard time. And many times, you know, after I preach, he critiques me. and I have a suspicion that Tom will grab me and say, okay, you told us about the kingdom. Now, what does it really mean for me? I'm going to beat you to that this time. How can we understand? Kingdom is still in some ways philosophical, mental. So to have a more real grasp on it, I can't do better than call your mind back to Matthew 5-7, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus proclaimed the coming of the kingdom, and he laid out the manifesto of the kingdom. We've talked about that passage from here quite a bit, but that's where he talked about the life, the new life of the kingdom citizens. Scott preached about that as the manifesto, the new life of the kingdom citizens, the people that will enter into this world of darkness and begin to shine their little candles and begin to shine their little lights in the world of darkness and continue to push back that darkness where Christ handed over the baton and continue to push it back. And I know that many times when we've read this, we've thought about how many souls we want. We've thought about the people with the 5 talents of gold as, you know, the big preachers who have had big crusades and who have won hundreds of thousands of souls and all that. And that is valid. There is soul winning in it. But it is the entirety of a preservation of a work that Christ started. And I feel like when he returns, there will be those who would, yeah, talk about crusades and doing great things. But I think there will be someone who would also come and who will say, Master, I thought my life was wasted, but you called me and you gave me forgiveness. And you gave me mercy. And you cleansed me. And I took that forgiveness and the mercy you showed me. And I entered into the marketplace of my world. And it was a tough situation. I cried my pillows wet. I thought I couldn't do it. But eventually I determined and I showed forgiveness to another. That which I received from you, I gave to someone else. And where previously reigned the power of darkness, where previously hatred and enmity controlled, the light of your forgiveness and mercy infiltrated the place. I have a feeling that another will come. They won't have a very great as we see it story. But they will say, I thought my life was all finished. I was abused as a young teenager. I'd lost all sense of dignity. But I met you, and you walked with me. I remember all the counseling. I remember the love in your community, in your fellowship, in the church. I remember people. It took a few years, but I eventually recovered it. And you know, Master, somehow my paths crossed with another person, a younger person who had had the same experience. And that victory which you gave me, I came alongside them and I walked with them. It took a few years, it wasn't easy. But over time, they gained victory. They regained a sense of dignity. They faced life again. Something good came out of it. Someone else will say, Master, you know I'm a teacher. I was shaping young minds. And, you know, you threw me in the United States, so the policy was that we couldn't be explicit with our faith there. But I tried to be a model. In a place where reigned darkness, and adults who try to teach young children that these are the things you do when you're adults. I tried to provide a model. I loved. I taught as best I could. I tried to come alongside them, the grieving, the hurt, the ones from broken families. I tried to be a mentor. And I think I raised about 2 lives. There'll be stories like that from plumbers, from doctors, from homeschooling moms, from... There'll be stories about people who have done little things, but in corners and places where darkness reigned, the light of the kingdom of God shone, and they continued to push back. I don't know which one will make Christ happier, the big crusades or these little stories. Before I close, I want to say something. Many times when a passage like this is preached, or even when you read it, what I have sensed from conversations in groups sometimes has been that there are people who read these passages or who hear sermons from it. And the first thing in their minds is, they're elderly maybe, the first thing in their minds is, oh my, I think I wasted my years. I think I've blown so many opportunities. I wish I came around when I was 21. So I cannot close without telling you, if you're that one today, no. That's not the point of this parable. The point of this parable is to come with an open hand and receive that which Christ is offering to you. and he will take all of what he has made you to be, including your experiences, including your gifts, including everything that you are. Open up your hands and receive it. Rejoice in it and be yourself wherever you are. Wherever you find yourself, be yourself. Finally, we won't always make it. This is not about scoring 100%. I think that's where the confusion is, because we read, you gave me 5 talents and I brought back 5 talents, and so we're always thinking in terms of percentage. There will be days when you will fail. I think there are much better Christians than I am. There have been days when I failed. I have had blown opportunities. I have had days that, as it were, I wasn't the one going home smiling that I made the better of that life's transaction. He who has given us so much and sends us to go and give will also himself continue to renew us, to forgive us, to pick us back up, to dust us off, and to take us along. He will give to us that which we need to remain partakers of his kingdom. It is his joy to call us into his family business. It is his joy to do this with us. Amen.